This episode features depictions of self-harm, violence, drug use, and disturbing imagery that some listeners may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. Bitter winds rose from the Great Lakes and billowed down the streets of Chicago's South Shore. The shortcut off Cranston Avenue didn't save Barbara Schuneman any time. She should have taken the route, but she wasn't thinking straight. Her heart was elsewhere. It was about to board a ship, and she was late to say goodbye. Barbara pulled her hood tighter, a barrier between herself and the cheer of the Christmas season. Her husband was once the captain of the Rouse Simmons, a 123-foot schooner that sank in a winter storm in 1912. Every winter, he traveled north to Wisconsin to bring evergreens back for the families of Chicago to decorate at Christmas. Christmas was their livelihood, but that didn't mean that Barbara couldn't resent it all the same. She knew, as all wives of sailors did, that the lake was as much a grave as it was a highway. Every trip's beginning could spell the end as she knew it. As she walked the length of the dock, Barbara paid no mind to the fishermen and rats. Her thoughts dwelled on her daughters, Elsie, Hazel, and Pearl, all at school. She wiped a frozen tear from her cheek and snapped back to the present. Her heart leapt as she saw her husband, Herman, waiting at the end of the dock. The Rouse Simmons loomed large behind him. His voice called out to Barbara on the wind, asking her to come with him this year, to spend Christmas at sea. She ran to him. All the nearby tackle seller saw next was a hooded woman leap off the dock with her arms outstretched, just before getting swallowed by the wake of the ships. It didn't matter that nobody else seemed to notice. The tackle seller rushed to save the woman. Despite the icy temperature, he jumped in after her. He might not have done it for a stranger, but he could have sworn the woman was the widow of a sailor he once knew. Welcome to Haunted Places, a Parcast original. I'm Greg Polson. Every Thursday, I take you to the scariest, eeriest, most haunted, real places on Earth. You can find all episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Haunted Places for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Haunted Places in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. This week, join me on a supernatural journey aboard the Rouse Simmons, a 19th century sailboat that sank to the depths of Lake Michigan in the winter of 1912. The Rouse Simmons, also known as the Christmas Tree Ship, was a 205-ton, three-masted schooner built in 1868. For most of its life, the sailboat delivered lumber from the mills of Wisconsin and northern Michigan to expanding urban areas like Chicago and Milwaukee. But as the German tradition of decorating evergreens became more popular in the States, the Rouse Simmons made a name for itself as the ship that delivered Christmas trees. Its captain was a man named Herman Schuneman. For over a decade, every winter, when Herman and the Rouse Simmons docked in Chicago, his crew sold the Christmas trees for meager profits, often giving them away to families that could not afford them. In 1912, the beloved ship met an untimely demise when it sank to the bottom of Lake Michigan in a winter storm. The bodies of its crew and captain were never found. Herman Schuneman left behind his wife Barbara and three daughters, Elsie, Hazel, and Pearl. Today, locals around Lake Michigan have reported seeing the ghost of the Rouse Simmons and its crew, sailing the waters it used to call home. What their intentions are remain unclear. The late October rain didn't bother George at all. He was excited. His sonar equipment was finally working again, and the scuba diver was finally going to find what he'd been looking for, the wreckage of the 700-ton Vernon. The steamer had sunk during a raging storm on Lake Michigan in October 1887, almost a century earlier. George lowered himself from his boat into the icy water. No matter how many layers he added under his wetsuit or years of experience he had, the temperature always came as a shock. He let his body adjust. The good news was that George wasn't diving blind today. He'd received a tip from some local fishermen whose nets kept snagging on something a couple miles off the coast of Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Something large. They thought it might be a ship. On days like today, George could easily mistake the Great Lake for an ocean. The horizon carried on for miles, and any signs of shoreline were hidden behind a mask of fog. Above the water, it was just George, his thoughts, and the occasional cry of a gull. Below the water could be anything. And that was the thrill of diving. The only large predator in the Great Lakes were bull sharks. Though they are among the most common of sharks, biologists also consider them the most dangerous due to their aggressive tendencies. George, however, had never seen one himself. He'd only heard stories, and why fear what you can't see? He secured his diving mask and regulator before submerging himself below the surface. Underwater, Lake Michigan felt like freedom. The rain, the noise, all of the worries of the world couldn't reach him down here. George checked the air in his tank. He should have about an hour of diving. Normally, the sun's rays could penetrate up to 600 feet, but it was hidden behind clouds today. The area of the lake that the fishermen spoke of reached about 200 feet below surface level. It wasn't long until George was enshrouded by darkness, and the shadow of his boat above him disappeared entirely. He switched on his light. His headlamp cast a narrow beam about 30 feet in front of him, more than enough to find a 700-ton ship, but not nearly enough to see every fish as they swam by. As George dove further, he could feel the thrill travel up his spine to his throat. He was like a kid at Christmas, waiting for Santa to arrive. He turned on his sonar equipment. Thankfully, it appeared to be working. He scanned the area around him to be sure. There wasn't anything around him that he could see. But then, something began to register on his sonar. He scanned the area with his headlamp, but didn't see any fish. He waited to see if the beeping would settle, but the sonar's frequency only increased, which meant whatever it was moving and getting closer. He whipped his head around. The beam of his light cut through the water, but only found tiny particles floating, undisturbed by any movement other than his own. It didn't make any sense. According to his sonar, something should be just a couple of feet away. Then, as quickly as the unknown disturbance came, it was gone. The frequency of the sonar returned to its slow, steady pace. He swung the equipment around to make sure. Maybe it was still broken. He resorted to the only thing he knew to do, turn the equipment off and then back on. He had just paid someone a few hundred dollars to get it fixed, so there was no reason that it shouldn't be working. Finding a ship, even one as large as the Vernon, would be difficult without it. And aimlessly exploring the depths could prove dangerous. But then again, going a little further couldn't hurt. George kicked onwards, pointing the sonar downward. It was registering the lake floor just fine. Maybe a reset was all it needed. George had a singular moment of relief before the sonar died. A moment later, so did his headlamp. At 150 feet below the surface, he could barely make out his hands in front of him. He felt odd, floating in an abyss. His mind wandered to all the people in his life he hadn't told about his dive today. And as the seeds of fear started to creep in, A slow, melodic noise sounded in the dark. The water distorted the edges of the sound, but it was unmistakably musical. It sounded familiar. It wasn't animal, but it wasn't far away. George's instinct was to resurface, but part of him wanted to follow the sound. It might be another diver signaling for help. He tried his headlamp again, hoping a little force would bring it back to life. George struck it as hard as he could. It flickered. In the flash of light, he thought he saw the outline of something up ahead. Something big. Bigger than any animal he'd ever seen. And then, he felt a fleshy mass brush his left hand. George tried to calm himself down. More likely than not, it was just a fish. A trout or bass or perch. Lake Michigan was full of them. He struck his headlamp harder. It didn't work. Not knowing what else to do, he flipped the light switch off and back on. It worked. The beam of light came back to life, if a little softer than before. But it was more than enough to confirm that George was indeed not alone. Just a couple of yards away, nestled neatly into the bottom of the lake floor, was a ship. Not the Vernon, that much he knew. It was much too small. It was a schooner with three battered and broken masts. The ship hadn't sunk recently. The wood was overtaken by growth. Vernon or not, it didn't matter. George lived for discoveries like these. Every shipwreck held its own mysteries, its own secrets. He swam closer. When he reached the starboard side of the ship, he brushed away some of the growth and took off his diving glove. He wanted to feel the wood of the ship on his bare skin. But as he ran his hand along the grain, a splinter caught the pad of his thumb. It was old wood. He removed the splinter. A thin trail of blood floated into his periphery. The blood didn't dissipate into its surroundings like George was accustomed to. Instead, it snaked its way along the side of the ship. And without knowing why, he followed it to the bow. All the way until he could make out the faded letters painted on the side of the ship. The Rouse Simmons. His heart leapt. He had found the Christmas tree ship, a ship that hadn't been seen since the storm of 1912. George checked his air tank. He still had a third of a tank left, which could be anywhere from 20 minutes to 10. At this depth, he was consuming air more quickly. But he couldn't pass up the opportunity to see what was inside the wreck. He'd be quick. He swam to the door that led down into the ship's hold and pulled. It was dark, but that was to be expected. But as he swam inside, as if by magic, tiny electric string lights flickered on around him, slowly revealing a graveyard before him. It was the skeletal remains of hundreds and hundreds of Christmas trees. Trees that never found their homes in 1912. George could feel the despair in the room. The number of disappointed families who never got their trees couldn't compare to the number of families whose fathers never returned. A chill ran up his spine. Where were the sailors, he wondered. And before he could find his answer, he heard a whisper behind him. It was a voice asking him to stay and spend the holidays. George turned to see where the voice came from, but instead of a man, he was greeted by a message on the wall. It read, "Merry Christmas. Welcome home." And then the old wooden door slammed shut. In 1971, a diver named Gordon Kent Bellrichard was looking for the remains of a steamer named the Vernon when he stumbled across the Rouse Simmons instead. After completing his dive, Bellrichard pointed authorities towards the wreck, which led to further dives and investigations. Several skeletons of Christmas trees were rescued from the wreckage. A few of the items from the ship are currently on display in Rogers Street Fishing Village Museum in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Its anchor can be seen at the entrance to the Milwaukee Yacht Club. The wreckage provided more clues as to how exactly the ship floundered. Experts now believe it was on its way to shore to escape the 1912 storm when ice and wind battered its masts and hull. But the ship took on too much water to ever reach the shore. Coming up, a harrowing message from the wreckage of the Rouse Simmons washes ashore. Thank you so much for listening. We want to take this time to tell you that Haunted Places will be taking the next 2 weeks off. We'll be back with a brand new episode on January 9th. In the meantime, we do have a special gift to share with you. While we're away, we'll be airing our listeners' most requested episodes of 2019. If you'd like to check out the most requested episodes from Parcast's other shows, subscribe to Parcast Presents to hear our best of 2019. From everyone here at Parcast, we'd like to wish you a happy holiday season. We're thankful for your support and look forward to bringing you even more unique and entertaining podcasts in the new year. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the story. When the Christmas tree ship docked in the harbors, it was typically lit with festive string lights and decorations. Its captain, Herman Schunemann, was known to many in Chicago as Captain Santa due to his love of Christmas and generosity. Just a few weeks after the Rouse Simmons sank in 1912, a number of Christmas trees washed ashore in Pentwater, Michigan. A decade later, Herman's wallet washed ashore too. Thanks to its oilskin wrapping, its contents were intact. Inside, he kept newspaper clippings, reports of Captain Santa and his charitable deeds, reminders of the joy he brought to so many children. Late November 1932, Amelia Fisher and her sister Hannah were exploring the beach in Pentwater, Michigan. It was just a mile from their home, and the two girls weren't supposed to be in the house until dark, an order from their parents. That was fine enough for Amelia. As the eldest, she set the parameters for their games. Currently, the sisters were role-playing as scientists, and they were hunting for polished stones to sell to the Queen of England in exchange for gold. Even in their make-believe world, the girls had no grand plans for the gold. More than anything, 13-year-old Amelia and 10-year-old Hannah wanted new school uniforms so that they wouldn't attract so many snickers and stares. Hannah was relegated to the scientist's assistant, while Amelia played the scientist and the Queen of England. Hannah's protests for a more exciting part fell on deaf ears. She was always at Amelia's whim. As Hannah wandered away from her sister to find a perfect rock, she heard a blood-curdling scream. Hannah knew the scream. It was Amelia. She walked back to find her. There was no need to run. Amelia wasn't in any danger. Hannah had just wandered too far away. It was Amelia's way of teaching Hannah a lesson. The first time it happened, Hannah was terrified. 3 years earlier, Hannah had sprinted to her sister, assuming that she would find her hurt, bleeding, or worse. Instead, Amelia was waiting, arms crossed, explaining that if Hannah got too far away, something could happen to one of them. They were better in numbers. Hannah felt terrible then, but by today, Amelia had cried wolf a few too many times. Just as Hannah suspected, her sister was fine. The game continued on, and Hannah continued to press her luck. She had found a set of footprints nearby, and she wanted to follow them. They were big, a man's, but they seemed to come out of the water and make their way to the pier. She followed the footprints all the way to a small rock formation. Laying against the rocks was an evergreen tree and a glass bottle, both on their sides. She wasn't interested in the tree. Their family sold Christmas trees. She was much more interested in the glass bottle. It was stained green and had to be worth something in Amelia's dumb game. She picked it up. Maybe she wouldn't share it with her sister. If she did, Amelia might take it. And it was hers. It said so on the tag. To Hannah, from Captain Santa. She turned and saw the footprints leading under the pier and into the water. And as she did, Amelia let her know that she had wandered too far. It wasn't until Hannah went to bed that she took the bottle out of its hiding place and under her mattress. She wanted to read what Captain Santa had written to her. She hadn't thought that Santa was a sailor, but she wasn't surprised. His sleigh was really just a flying boat. Hannah needed to make sure Amelia was asleep, so she got up to place a hand in front of Amelia's face. Amelia was breathing through her mouth. She was asleep. Hannah slipped on socks and snuck out of the room. Luckily, she didn't have to pass her parents' bedroom to get to the kitchen. As long as she was quiet, she would be fine. Their family kept one of the few electric lights they owned in the kitchen. She could reach it fine in the dark. She knew the path well. 20 paces down the hall, left, then an immediate right. She felt for the light and clicked it on. The bottle was more beautiful than she remembered. To Hannah, from Captain Santa. She had written letters to Santa for years, but now he was writing back. She shook the wooden cork loose, tipped the bottle over, and let the parchment drift onto the hardwood floor. This was it. In shiny red ink was a message that made her heart skip a couple of beats. Come celebrate Christmas with me. Shh, it'll be our secret. She couldn't contain her excitement. How could she be so lucky? She thought back to how she behaved that year. She hadn't been a good student or a good sister. She complained about her chores and her schoolwork. But she did do her chores, and she did finish her schoolwork, eventually. She also hadn't pummeled Aaron Sullivan in the schoolyard, and Aaron Sullivan deserved to be pummeled. Maybe Hannah was being rewarded for her restraint. Ultimately, it didn't matter why. What mattered was that it was happening. She turned off the light and ran back to her room. Buried under her covers, she couldn't sleep. Not sleeping became a pattern in the days to come. She would try to go to bed, but she couldn't. She would lie awake, dreaming of her day with Santa. Hannah didn't tell anyone that she wasn't sleeping, not even after she began to hallucinate that the walls were leaking water, not even when she started seeing the figure of a man standing in the yard outside her window at night. She confided in Amelia, but Amelia promised that it was only her imagination. At first, Mr. and Mrs. Fisher were only worried about their daughter because she was so well behaved. Hannah did everything she was told without complaint. It wasn't until they noticed Hannah's hollow eyes and cheeks that they became concerned. She was eating less. Hannah insisted she was fine. She was just excited for Christmas. But what Christmas had to do with Hannah spending every evening by the pier at Pentwater Beach, nobody was sure. It didn't matter how severe the weather was. She would watch the waves crash onto the shore until dinner time. Amelia would invent new games, even promise that Hannah could be whatever she wanted. Hannah couldn't tell her sister that she was waiting for another sign from Santa, so she just stared into her sister's eyes until they welled with tears and she ran away. Then, Hannah got sick. Pneumonia. Her parents took her out of school and forbade her from leaving the house. They demanded that she stay in bed until she got better. She didn't disobey them. Santa wouldn't want her to. Instead, she lay there motionless and vacant for days, even as doctors, family, friends, and priests came to check on her, even as she listened to her sister cry herself to sleep every night. Hannah stayed in bed until Christmas Eve came. In the middle of the night, Amelia jolted up. From the dead of sleep, she heard the front door slam. She knew who it was even before she checked. Hannah was gone. It was pitch black when the Fishers reached Pentwater Beach. Whatever footprints there would be gone by the morning, ruined by the wind and waves. Their shouts for their daughter could barely be heard over the crashing tides. Hannah Fisher was reported missing to the police on Christmas morning. In the investigations to come, no sign or body was found. For 2 weeks after Hannah disappeared, Amelia Fisher visited Pentwater Beach every day to look for her sister. Mostly, she was furious with her sister for leaving. But with every step, her emotions changed. She was sad. She was hopeful. She was inconsolable. She was numb from looking. There were two lost girls on Pentwater Beach, and Amelia was one of them. On the 12th day of looking, Amelia gave up. Her lips were salty from tears. She sat down on the beach and screamed. Hannah didn't come running. Instead, a bottle washed up at Amelia's feet. The glass was stained red. It had a green ribbon tied around its neck, and on the tag were the words, "To Amelia, from your sister." It had a piece of parchment inside. She looked out to see where it came from, but there were no boats on the lake. She smashed the bottle on a rock. In messy, scrawled handwriting that was unmistakably her sister's were two words. Save me. It wasn't just Christmas trees and a wallet that washed ashore from the Rouse Simmons after it sank in 1912. The eeriest of items washed ashore in the weeks after it sank. It was a message in a bottle. Though the message technically could have been from a number of ships that were lost during the same storm, the bottle was corked with cut pine wood. Inside was this note. Friday. Everybody, goodbye. I guess we are all through. During the night, the small boat washed overboard, leaking bad. Invald and Steve lost two. God help us. Coming up, the legend of the Rouse Simmons lives on in Chicago. Now, back to the story. Today, the memory of the Rouse Simmons lives on in Chicago's holiday traditions. Its arrival is reenacted by the U.S. Coast Guard with a ship called the Mackinac. With the assistance of hundreds of volunteers, thousands of trees are delivered by boat every year and given to families who otherwise could not afford them. It's organized by the Chicago Christmas Ship Committee and assisted by the Coast Guard, Navy Pier, Ada S. McKinley Community Services, and countless private individuals. Among the many volunteers are members of the Young Marines. The most interesting fact about Joseph Scaldini was that he was a young Marine, so it came up fairly frequently. The self-proclaimed professional stoner dropped it in casual conversation whenever Holland High School faculty members were around. He had signed up as a joke in 2009, the same year that The Lonely Island released their hit single, I'm on a Boat, featuring T-Pain. 4 years later, the killer Facebook profile picture he took was no longer relevant. But he couldn't quit now. He was stuck. College applications were around the corner, and he had already quit everything else. If his last two PSAT scores were any indication, he was going to need the Young Marines on his applications. It wasn't that being a young Marine was going to kill Joseph. It's just that the young Marines appreciated leadership, teamwork, discipline, and a healthy, drug-free lifestyle. And Joseph shared his life's motto, Live Moss, with his favorite fast food restaurant. In his world, discipline meant completing No Shave November. He knew exactly how many young Marine events he could skip before getting kicked out, and he had missed all of them. He should have attended the Brookdale Retirement Home event. At least the elderly were kind of hilarious. And now he had to spend Saturday at the local tree farm. Joseph jumped at the chainsaw a few feet away. Someone should have warned him that there would be so many saws. He didn't sign up for Friday the 13th. He signed up for A Christmas Carol. Today's event involved loading Christmas trees from the tree farm onto a boat headed for Chicago and then onto trucks. The trucks would then deliver them to the less fortunate. The boat as the middleman seemed pointless to Joseph. Pointless activities aside, he would get through today's event like he got through all of them, keeping quiet, always walking with purpose, and without a destination. And weed. There were plenty of people fighting to do the work. It was like the Olympics of charity. Everyone was in competition to be seen doing the most. Honestly, if Joseph did anything more, he'd be stealing their joy. By the time 11 a.m. rolled around, all the trees were loaded onto the boat. There were more than 1,000. Joseph helped lift 2 of them and directed, like, 6. Now that he was on the boat, Joseph needed to sit down because he wasn't feeling well. He couldn't pinpoint what was making him feel so ill. And his paranoia was worse than usual. He kept hearing voices, like people were talking about him behind his back. He hadn't felt this way since his first bong hit, in 6th grade. All of a sudden, someone grabbed his shoulder. It was a man, tall, handsome, and smiling. He was dressed in an old-fashioned sailor's outfit. The man asked how Joseph was doing, and then commented on the beautiful weather. Did the man know about the blunt in Joseph's pocket? Could he see it in his eyes? His name tag said Santa. Did that mean he's important? No, all Joseph had to do was be cool. It's just another human being asking another human being how they're doing. That's what people do. Often. He reached into his pocket to make sure he had his eye drops. He had already used them. As long as Joseph responded, everything would be fine. Joseph told the man he was good and that, yes, the weather was also good. But the conversation didn't end. The man asked Joseph where he planned on spending the holidays. Did the man know Joseph's parents? Did he know he'd peed on one of the trees? It was an accident. Not all trees go into people's homes. It's an honest mistake. After what could have been a second or 10 minutes, Joseph told the Santa man that he wasn't sure. That seemed to do the trick. The man laughed, told Joseph that he hoped wherever he ended up would be nice, and walked away. 40 minutes later, Joseph was feeling much better. He had confidently paced the ship a few times. He went below deck and used the head. He said hi to someone he didn't know. He was doing well. He was even getting used to the voices. The next time he saw the man with the Santa name tag, it was in a black and white photograph hanging on a wall of the ship. The man wasn't alone. He was with a number of other sailors. They were obviously invested in the authenticity and period nature of today's event. They were wearing outfits from the early 20th century. Joseph supposed it was a nod to the original Christmas tree ship. The photograph didn't make Joseph feel good, though. He couldn't tell if he needed to smoke more or less. He could have sworn the men were bleeding from their eyes. But when he did a double take, they were still just adult men playing dress-up. The boat came to a stop. Everyone else on board seemed to know what was going on, except for Joseph. They were all gathering on one side of the vessel. Joseph tried to get close enough to see what was happening. Someone from the Coast Guard was saying something to the crowd. Oh, right. He remembered they said there would be a ceremony. The man began telling the story of the Rouse Simmons. He said something about a guy named Herman. He gestured at the water. Joseph was only vaguely paying attention. Another soldier tossed a wreath into the water to mark the spot. Then there was a moment of silence for the lives lost. As the crowd dispersed, Joseph neared the edge of the boat. He saw the man again, the fake Santa. Only this time, the man was in the water and screaming for help. He was floating a few feet away from the wreath, and he wasn't alone. He was with all the men from the photograph, all of whom appeared to be drowning, screaming for help. Joseph looked around at the other passengers, but none of them seemed to notice or care. There were plenty of far more qualified people around who could help them. Maybe they were reenactors. What a weird tradition. But nobody was watching, and the boat was starting again. As it pulled away, Joseph followed the scene as he traced the railing to the back of the boat. He watched the wreath float over to one of the men struggling to keep his head above water. He grabbed it, but the wreath went under, and the man went with him. Even if it was a reenactment, he was drowning. Joseph ran over to a woman with a clipboard and asked about the men in the water. She was confused. If he was referring to the men who had drowned in 1912, their bodies were never found. He wasn't. He meant the men in the water right over there. He shouted louder. There were so many people around, but they were all staring at him blankly. Joseph began to panic. He was now the center of attention, and the boat was getting further away from the men who needed their help. The screams of the men might as well be right next to him. Joseph spun around. He needed help. Someone needed to help. The woman with the clipboard grabbed his shoulders. She told him that they were helping by delivering trees to families who deserved them. No. Joseph felt crazy. Was everyone just going to let those men die? Was he witnessing a cult? A Coast Guard conspiracy? Who were those men? Where were the life preservers? Joseph broke free from the woman. He was attracting a crowd. He tried to reason with the strangers, but everyone was staring at him like he was the crazy one. They were going to be bystanders to the death of every man out there. Two members of the Coast Guard rushed to him, grabbed him, and tried to bring him away. But the screams of the men persisted, as if they were inches from where he stood. Joseph wasn't strong enough to overtake the members of the Coast Guard, so he didn't resist as they held him in place. He apologized for making a scene over and over until they released their grips. The next time that Joseph saw an opportunity, he took it. He sprinted for the railing and vaulted over it toward the dark water. The impact of Joseph hitting the lake almost knocked the wind out of him. The icy temperature shocked every nerve in his body. He wasn't a good swimmer, but he had it in his mind, just follow the screams of the men. So that's exactly what he did. He took a big breath and swam. He had no plan for when he got to the men, but he traveled with purpose. He paid no mind to the rescue team that swam after him. As he swam, the icy currents numbed his body. Contrary to everything he should be feeling, he started to feel a warmth inside of him, like the water was not bitter, but comfortable, cozy even. He felt like he was back in bed with a fire by his side. The crowd aboard the Mackinac didn't see a boy swimming anywhere but down to the bottom of the lake. The rescuers dove after him, but they lost him. They waited, expecting him to surface, but he didn't. The next day, a team of divers searched the lake for Joseph, but his body was never found. Today, you can still see the Mackinac delivering trees in Chicago every Christmas, in memory of the Rouse Simmons and its captain, Herman Schuneman. And who knows, if you're not careful, you might see the Rouse Simmons sailing its waters as well, waiting to celebrate the holidays that it missed. Thanks again for tuning into Haunted Places. We'll be back on Thursday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Haunted Places and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all your favorite Parcast originals, like Haunted Places, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Haunted Places on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Haunted Places in the search bar. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Haunted Places was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Kenny Hobbs, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Travis Clark, and Joel Stein. This episode of Haunted Places was written by Connor Sampson, with writing assistance by Drew Cole. I'm Greg Polson. Just a reminder that we'll be back with a new episode on January 9th. In the meantime, we'll be playing our listeners' most requested episodes of 2019. Thanks again for listening. We hope you have a wonderful holiday season.